I'm Elena Landsberg-Lewis, your host of Grandmothers on the Move, the podcast that kicks old stereotypes to the curb. Come meet these creative, outrageous, authentic, adventurous, irreverent, and powerful disruptors and influencers. Grandmothers, from the living room to the courtroom, making powerful contributions in every walk of life. We know them most intimately as loving caregivers, the older women in our lives with a thousand stories about their grandchildren and pictures in their purses. In this podcast, you'll come to know even more about our grandmothers. They are galvanized, determined, and are guaranteed to get you thinking. What drives them? What are they up to? What is the potential of grandmother power, and how is it changing the world? Grandmothers are on the move. You don't want to be left behind.
Hi, it's Elena. Welcome back to Grandmothers on the Move. Today I have something quite different and rather important. I'm speaking with Andre Picard. He's a health reporter and columnist for the Globe and Mail, where he has been a staff writer since 1987. I'm speaking to him on the occasion of the release of his new book, Neglected No More, The Urgent Need to Improve the Lives of Canada's Elders in the Wake of a Pandemic. I know this is Canadian-centric for all of my listeners who are not from Canada, but there are so many lessons and insights about what has happened to our elders in long-term care and around the crisis of COVID that I think it's germane for all of us. Andre is a tremendous writer. He's the author of five other best-selling books. He's an eight-time nominee for the National Newspaper Awards, Canada's top journalism prize, and past winner of a prestigious Michener Award for meritorious public service journalism. He was named Canada's first public health hero by the Canadian Public Health Association and a champion of mental health by the Canadian Alliance on Mental Illness and Mental Health, and received the Queen's Diamond Jubilee Medal for his dedication to improving healthcare. And I think I speak for a lot of us when I say that Andre's insights, his expertise, his knowledge of pandemics, of global health, of public health, has been a touchstone for many of us during these confounding and surreal and difficult times to navigate the information. So it's a real pleasure to be able to speak to Andre about this book, which makes an extraordinarily important contribution to understanding what has happened to older people in the pandemic and what we're going to do as we emerge from it. Welcome, Andre. It's wonderful to have you on Grandmothers on the Move.
Oh, thank you.
I got an early copy of Neglected No More, and I dove into it. You chronicled how we got here, and it's so carefully and thoughtfully put together, but it's a very devastating story. And I kept thinking to myself, we have universal healthcare covering doctors and hospitals, and how do we explain how this abysmal parallel system of elder anti-care or uncare develop? And I wonder if you can share with us, how do we get here?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's like everything in Canada, sort of a mixture of our history and taking stuff for granted, assuming we're nice. Some people in society are easier to neglect, you know, to be invisible, and it's particularly true of older people, older women. You know, I say in the book that this is really the intersection of kind of ageism and sexism and racism, because elder care is about older women being invisible. The people who care for them tend to be immigrant women who are underpaid, exploited. It's sort of the perfect storm of who is not valued in society.
When the book did come out, I started watching some of the interviews. I just wanted to see, what were people focusing on? The book is rich with a lot of information, past and present, about the system and stories of individuals. And it's an incredibly compelling read. And I wanted to see what other people were focusing on when they were speaking with you, Andre. And I was kind of stunned, to be honest with you. And this may have happened, but in the interviews I saw, there were several. No one mentioned women. No one mentioned the gender dimension. Very few of them mentioned the intersection of race and age and gender.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. You know, I'm a member of the media, so when I'm interviewed by the media, it's interesting what they focus on. And I think we kind of in the media get hung up in the day-to-day, in the present. So a lot of the focus in the interviews I've been doing about the book has been on COVID. You know, how did COVID happen? And I think some of this other stuff is just makes us really uncomfortable. We don't like to talk about that stuff in Canada. We're not racist. We're not ageist. You know, we treat our immigrants well. That's our image of ourselves. And people don't like to see that challenged. It doesn't make them feel good and they feel powerless. And so, yeah, I kind of understand why some of these themes get forgotten. In the longer interviews, they tend to get into them. But when you're doing kind of those quick hits that you do when you're doing book promotion, it just tends to be in the present. It tends to be about, you know, the people who are in these homes who actually can afford them in the first place, you know, wasn't it terrible what happened happened to them. Yeah, so a lot gets unsaid, unfortunately, and that's why you do something like a book, to get into these deeper issues that you can't cover in the day-to-day. You know, we always say in the media, we don't do motion pictures, we do snapshots. So and the book gives you a chance to delve into stuff that we don't normally touch on.
That makes perfect sense. And the complexity of it, too, really demands a deeper look and more of a chronicle. And many have said this, how COVID has sort of exposed the fault lines along which neglected, underserviced, underpaid, undervalued, vulnerable populations are living in the inequities in our systems. But I do think that those systemic vulnerabilities that you talk about and that you explore, they're really not known well or understood well. And I wonder if you can talk about that a bit.
Yeah, I think generally it's true that people don't understand, or they don't take the time to understand policy and to understand things like our health system. I often say, because I've been writing about this for so long, for decades, I've come to the conclusion that every problem we have in healthcare is about structure and it's about administration. It's not about medicine. It's not about money. And medicine and money are easy things to write about, and structure and administration are really boring things to write about. So that's the challenge, I think, is making people understand that this stuff matters. Bureaucracy matters, policy making matters, all that stuff that happens invisibly in the back rooms. That's, I think, a challenge for me in my day-to-day. And it's even a bigger challenge in the book, is how do you bring that to life? How do you make people understand the structure matters and that it is comprehensible if you put some effort into it? So I think the thing you try to do in a book like this, or I try to do, is bring these issues to life with just personal stories. You know, just tell the story of someone who's just desperately trying to keep their dying wife at home. And what does it take to do that? You know, and they just tell their story and you realize, what does it take? It takes $1 million, and it takes just a lot of backbone, and it takes a lot of fighting with the administration. So you explain the structure by telling of people's frustrations and sometimes telling of their successes, because those occur as well. But it's true, people don't really understand this. And then they get this really harsh lesson that they don't really want when it hits them like a freight train. When they need to get in the system, they just realize all the impediments and just how overwhelming it is. And I hope that a book like this would kind of help people prepare for that and realize you have to talk about these things you don't really want to talk about in advance. About, you know, how am I going to die? Where am I going to live when I have a disability from my chronic illness? What do I want to tell my children to do when I'm incapable of making decisions anymore? These are really tough conversations, but they're a lot tougher when you're in crisis. You have to have them ahead of time. So to me, this book is just like a big kitchen table conversation, like an intimate conversation with people who are really kind enough to share with me on that level. And I try to put it into some policy perspective.
And I have to say, I absolutely read it just as you describe it. In fact, I was reading it at the kitchen table, and at one point I looked up and said to my partner, we need to talk. I remember reading all the stories of terrible things that were happening in long-term care homes, and I made some assumptions about why that was. And I thought it was very interesting in the book. It was very helpful to peel back the layers and see some of the structure that doesn't exist and the lack of coordination. And one of the things that struck me so much, and I think I knew it, Andre, but I hadn't turned my sights on it, and you really, chapter and verse, talk about it. The whole issue around personal support workers. 90% are women. I can't say I was surprised. Two-thirds are over 40, that for many, many of them, English and French are their second or third languages, that there are 350,000 or 400,000, I think you said, of them. It was really overwhelming to think about how much they are carrying, how you talk about their realities that are endemic to a broken system.
Yeah, I think the ingrained ageism in our policies, it is infuriating and maddening and sickening at various times. So I think that's what I tried to bring to life. I tried to not be too hopeless. Like, I think to me, I couldn't write a book like this if I ultimately didn't have hope it could be fixed. And I think it can. And probably we can talk about that in a minute. But I do want to come back to your issue of the personal support workers, because I think it's a really important one. I think one of the things COVID really made us realize is who are essential workers in our society. And they're people that we take for granted, right? They're the invisible people became visible. No one more so than PSWs. So personal support workers, in some part of the countries, they're called care aides or orderlies. The nomenclature is very complicated for no good reason, but all these folks who are the eyes and ears and hands of your loved ones in care, you know, that's what they do. They help them with feeding, bathing, toileting, you name it. They do all the stuff that allows people to survive when they are chronically ill. And who are they most? Again, you know, you said it very well. They're mostly racialized women. The sort of typical personal support worker is a Filipino woman who comes over as a nanny and then transitions, saves up her money from being a nanny, takes a 16-week or 30-week course, and then gets this job as a personal support worker. Those who really are lucky become registered practical nurses. You know, I had the real pleasure of meeting a lot of folks of personal support workers, all these Filipino women of various ages. In Quebec, it's all Haitian women, depending on the part of the country you're in. And they're just so dedicated and so hardworking and so exploited. And the really interesting thing for me is they weren't particularly bitter or angry about their lousy pay or their lousy benefits. What they're really heartbroken about is they just kept saying, I don't have enough time to do this job properly. And it was so touching to hear that over and over again, just this recognition they want to do the job well and they can't. And just hearing things like someone, you know, I was writing about a home where 100 people had died. So half the residents had died and the only people there taking care of them are these personal support workers. And then you realize they're getting $13 an hour to be at the bedside of people dying horrific deaths and putting their own lives at risk because they didn't have enough personal protective equipment, et cetera. They could get paid more working at McDonald's, but they do this work and they do it willingly. And they do it lovingly, and we just take such advantage of them. It's shocking.
Yeah, it's shocking. And there were times where I just found myself feeling almost violently upset by the injustice of it, but this inexplicable inhumanity of it. It's hard to wrap one's mind around it. And you use the term elder apartheid.
Yeah, I thought about that terminology a lot. And I thought, you know, it is harsh, but it's also accurate. And, you know, why is it apartheid? It's we take people once they get to a certain age, a certain level of disability, and you know, the real thing, I think what it ultimately comes down to in Western society, what we value is money, right? So once you stop becoming an earning member of society, you become less important. And then doubly so when you're older and triply so when you have a disability. So what we do is we take them and, you know, we take great care of people in our health system if they need physician care, if they need hospital. So the acute care, we still do well. But once you need that chronic care, once you need housing, once you need to be fed, you just fall off a cliff. You literally get shunted often to the outskirts of town to a big prison-like facility with 200 or 300 beds. And that's where you live. And to me, that's apartheid. It's just taking people and, you know, stripping them of their citizenship and their choice and their rights to live life in a dignified manner. And that's what we do. And it's not surprising. I'm a big reader of history, of medical history, because I think it often explains a lot of our current problems and explains them very well in home care. This is a system that came up through the penal system. Didn't come up through the health system. We've added on a little bit of care marginally at the end, but that's what it's all about. Until 1961 in Ontario, people in care homes could still be punished for not doing their chores. They could be put in solitary confinement. A lot of homes still had uniforms. So it really, that's how we treated elders until we had this enlightenment, you know, in the 60s, where we developed a lot of social programs, but it was very slow to come and the change has not been radical enough.
And there's a peculiar tier. You looked at Sunnybrook, how veterans are treated. And I just don't understand how you look at both standards or quality of life and the kind of care that people are receiving and make that distinction. You know what I'm saying? I don't want to be insensitive to those who have served, but I don't see the distinction between how people contribute to their society, pay taxes, do their jobs, live their lives for the betterment of their community, their family. And how do we make a distinction between one type of older person or another?
Yeah, it is a very much an arbitrary, unfair distinction. And, you know, the first people who will tell you that are the veterans themselves. They recognize this, that it makes no sense that they get good care. They get decent care. They get more home care, better home long-term care. They get better care across the gamut. And they understand that it makes no sense that their neighbors don't, for example, the same age as them. So the reason I use Sunnybrook, it is an example of hope. because if we can do this for our veterans and we do provide great care for them, there's no reason we can't do it for everyone else. So I talk a bit about the unfairness, but then I talk about the opportunity. It's an example that everything we know we need to do and everything we have to do, we can do because we're doing it now. We're just not doing it for enough people. So I think to me, that's a hopeful story in that it tells us all the solutions are there. It's just a question of scaling up our successes, of expanding who we think in society is deserving. And I certainly, like you said, to think that all elders are as deserving as our veterans. And that's in no way does that underplay their contribution. Quite the contrary, I think that's exactly what it was about, right? It was about creating a democracy, a better country. That's what presumably our soldiers fought for.
And you're quite right. It does feel hopeful when you're reading it because you think, well, it's not like we have no idea what could happen or what it could look like. You gave examples of other standards of care. Talk about Denmark as the gold standard for aging in place, aging within the community, and the UK as the number one place to die on the quality of death index. I think if I remember correctly, that Canada was ninth. And so there are models out there. But in terms of these other standards, I'd love to hear from you sort of what do they really teach us? Do we want to replicate them? Can we replicate? What is it that we take away from them in our own context?
Yeah, and I write about this often about larger healthcare systems. You can't just transport them because culture matters, country matters. To me, the big lesson of Denmark, of Norway, of Sweden, all these Nordic countries that have good care and they have very different systems, but the big difference between them and us is philosophy. So Denmark, you know, in the 1980s, started thinking about the demographic changes coming, the aging of society, and they realized, hey, we're going to have a lot of older people in society soon. What are we going to do about it? So for one thing, they planned. We just sort of put our blinkers on. We didn't want to think about that. We were magically surprised that baby boomers are now old. You know, we've known this for 60 years, it was coming, but we're surprised. But they were less surprised. So they decided just to plan. And then the starting point was a philosophy. Their philosophy was, we want our elders to stay in the community as long as humanly possible. Once you have that cultural belief, political statement, everything else is actually really easy. You just give life to your values, right? So they, I think, articulate their values much, much better. And then they create a system that does that. You know, in Denmark, they have invested a lot into home care, into subsidized housing, supportive housing, you know, sending people to help you out. In Canada, one of the reasons that people go to long-term care, they go for a lot of banal reasons. They can't shovel anymore. They have trouble with their groceries. That's not a reason to send someone off to an institution. It's a reason to send somebody to help them do their groceries. And then even when people need care homes, and there's no question some people do, you know, people with advanced dementia, they're at risk if they wander, et cetera. They need to be in a controlled environment. But again, that environment doesn't have to look like a prison. So in Denmark, I go to Copenhagen, I can walk down the street to family home, nursing home, family home. You don't know the difference because they live in a home-like environment. And the whole philosophy is people are going to live with dignity regardless of their age. So I often use the analogy, like, imagine if our daycares looked like our elder care facilities. People would be outraged. They'd be in the streets with pitchforks, you know. Let's put 300 kids in a place and have them sleep overnight to four to a room and to tell them, well, you know, if you've defecated in your diaper, sorry, we don't have enough staff. You're going to have to wait 8 hours just to live with it, kid. Put it in that context. We would never do that to children. So why do we do it to older people? And I don't say that to infantilize. I say that to give this perspective that we, why are the standards different for an elder rather than a child?
Absolutely. There were some very important things that I think you talked about around elders being treated as commodities. I love the example you talked about, relationship-based, not transactional-based home care. There were many examples that I could see you were giving us things to think about and to gravitate to. There are models out there. There's the naturally occurring retirement communities, the radical rest homes, which I loved and would love to hear you talk a little bit more about. But what is it that we need here? Is it political will? What is the spark for the revolution? And if not, like COVID was the first time we ever heard that people are struggling in long-term care homes, that there are egregious circumstances, that the home care is extraordinarily difficult and uncoordinated and things don't work the way they ought to. It can be very expensive. I mean, this is not the first time we're having these revelations.
Yeah, that's always the big question. You're right. We do know everything. There's been 150 reports written about how to reform healthcare and long-term care in general since the advent of Medicare. So we know every single thing that have to know. We know how to resolve it. So where's the political will come from? Well, I think in a perverse way, some of it's going to come from COVID. You know, we've had 22,000 COVID deaths in Canada, and 16,000 of those were in long-term care facilities, so almost 80%. So if 16,000 deaths isn't an impetus to act, I don't know what is. So I think that is going to force some action. But I think what's more important is that we act in the proper way. So in Canada, we tend to resolve or tackle problems in a very siloed fashion. Doug Ford has said on many occasions, you know, he's outraged about what happened in care homes, and what he's going to do is build more beds. And to me, that's the absolute worst thing we could do, is just build more mediocre care. That's not what we need. We need a rethink of the system. So I think that the way to mobilize political will is just to talk about what I've mentioned many times, is to just talk about respect of our elders. How do we give life to that? We have to look at elder care as a continuum. It's not about putting people in homes. It's not about home care. It's not about subsidized housing. It's not about supportive living. It's not about creating community groups and respite care for caregivers. It's about doing all those things and doing them in a coordinated fashion. So again, if I look at a place like Denmark, the cost argument goes out the window. They don't spend more money than us. They actually spend less on healthcare. And it's because it is a continuum that older people there get great primary care. And that means that they go into hospital less, and they go into hospital less, so they go into care homes less. It's all connected. And we in Canada, we do a lot of really good sickness care, but we're terrible at preventing care and of doing the aftercare and the rehabilitation. So just an example, another one from Denmark that I love, they're big on something called reablement. So in Canada, if you get home care, if you're lucky enough to get some, and the maximum is 3 hours a day, so it's not enough for most people who need serious care. But in those 3 hours a day, what you get allocated is tasks. You get a person come in and they do these specific tasks. I'm going to feed you lunch. I'm going to bathe you. I'm going to change your continence pad if that's required. And I'm going to do it whether you want it or not, because this is on my checklist. In Denmark, they believe in teaching people how to do stuff. So they say, oh, you know, you're losing your eyesight, you're having trouble cooking. I'm going to teach you how a blind person cooks. You know, it's sort of the old biblical teach a man to fish approach rather than fishing for them. And that gives people more dignity, and it gives them more control, and it makes them feel alive to do this stuff. Nobody wants to sit there and be served their lunch, spoon-fed their lunch. Nobody wants to have someone change their continence pads. All this stuff is not fulfilling. And the longer you can avoid that, the better for everyone involved.
It strikes me as I'm listening to you that you spoke to so many people involved in every dimension of this, nurses' unions and the care workers themselves and family members who were caring for other family members. You have so many voices in your head at this point and so many perspectives. There were a couple of times where I really was sure that where you were going to go was to say privatized long-term care is the problem. And in fact, it's not where you ended up. And it was much more complex than that. And just going back to what you said, because I want to explore it a little bit more with you, going back to what is our approach to aging? How do we value older people in our society? I think there's a racialized and gendered dimension, even to philosophically, how do we think about this? What do women need as they're aging? What do people in underserved and under-resourced communities need as they're aging? How do families approach these things differently? What's available to them? Where you didn't actually come up in the book with your ABC of what needs to happen next, but were there a couple of first steps that you thought, this is how we get to a fundamental shift in how people think about aging and how we deal with the ageism?
Yeah, I think, you know, part of it is you have to be pragmatic about it. So I think to do the practical stuff. So you mentioned the issue of privatization, and that question is always asked of me, and people are always like shocked that I don't say, oh, we have to get rid of private. I'm reluctant to say things like that because I think those are just simplistic solutions to complex issues. I answer that question in two stages. I say, we don't need private for-profit care. If it was gone tomorrow, I'd be more than happy. We don't need it. But I think we have to understand why it's there before we just say, get rid of it. And it's there because governments won't invest in infrastructure, because they don't want debt. We have this obsession about we can't have debt, so we don't build public buildings. You know, we have horrible looking public institutions because we're afraid to do like Europeans and spend a little more and make things look nice and make them comfortable. So we have this very Presbyterian approach to all our healthcare. So I think if you just say get rid of private, what we don't need is more mediocre care. You know, we just don't need the government saying, oh, get rid of private and do nothing differently. So I think I'd like to challenge people to think a bit differently about it. So how do we change that again? I think we have to remember we've made some dramatic, huge changes in society. We have to remind ourselves it's doable. And I think that's the key element is people just get a bit too resigned about this too easily. I just hear it over and over. Oh, I agree with you, but it's too expensive and it's too complicated. It's not too expensive. I've talked about that. It doesn't cost any more in other countries to do this much better. In fact, it costs less. Maybe we need a little bit of injection of money because we've neglected this for 30 or 50 years. So a little bit of money required, especially upfront to fix things. But it's all fixable. You know, as we've talked about, we know every single solution. And I think that the promising thing is we've solved every problem. We've solved them all 10 times in various pilot projects, in various isolated islands of excellence. And we just have to build on those successes. You know, I hate hearing people saying this is too complicated to fix. It's not. It's complex, but it's not complicated at all.
That's extraordinarily frustrating to make it so complicated that you just feel paralyzed by it. When you were writing the book, was there something that really gave you hope? There's still possibility for some innovative and dignified approaches to this?
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, there's all kinds of great successes and there's a lot of hopeful people out there. And I think it's important to remember that. In the book, I deliberately made a decision to not choose worst case scenarios. I talked about people who are having difficulty navigating the system and all, but all of them were people who, you know, did relatively well, even the workers. These are all hopeful people. So I made a point of doing that. I think the one aspect where we're doing a lot and where there's the most opportunity is the one we don't talk about at all. It's just the community sector. So you know this from, you know, the AIDS sector much better than I, but AIDS was all about the community coming together and rallying when governments didn't care, when politicians didn't care. And I think we're seeing that kind of movement in elder care. One of the most uplifting things for me is I've been doing some of these town hall things on a place called Clubhouse. So this is a new app for very young people and just like hundreds of young people taking interest in elder care. That really gives me hope. Things like I talk in the book, you mentioned Radical Rest Home. Just this idea of building apartments differently so that they encourage people of different ages to mix. So a radical rest home, an example, is a bunch of people who are gay and lesbian and intersex and put them in a building, but some of them are 90 years old and some of them are 20 years old. It's like a kibbutz, but it's on land, you know, it's in a building, for example. And these things exist and they're fabulous. And one of my favorite things when I was writing about the radical rest home is someone who said to me, you know what I hate about elder care is this assumption that old people only want to talk to old people. It's not true. They want to be alive and they want to interact with younger people. And the younger people, you know, whenever you get an opportunity to sit down with a 95-year-old, and I'm privileged to be able to do this because of my work, their stories are just spellbinding. They're fascinating and you learn so much from them. And just that building of communities differently rather than, you know, shunting people off, I think really gives us hope. Another example, I write about one in Toronto called Sprint, so a seniors group. And they do something that is so, once you think about it, you think it's so self-evident. Why don't we do it everywhere? Is they take these apartment buildings and instead of, you know, 14, or I wrote about one building once where 40 different home care workers were coming in and out of an apartment complex every day. So what did they do in this group in Toronto? They said, why don't we just hire two or three home care workers and they live in the building? And instead of all these people coming and going, we don't know who they are. Let's have our own home care team and they live here. And that's what they did. And the care is, of course, fabulous. It's none of this regimented, oh, we're going to give you lunch at this time. It's like you knock on the door. Oh, hi, Mrs. Smith. I'm here for lunch. Oh, you're not hungry? Sure, I'll come back in an hour. I'll go down the hall and I'll give Mrs. Jones her shower. And it's so much more flexible and sensible. And again, it's more dignified. People get to have some choice in their life. And that's one of the first things we do to older people is we take away all their choices. And if you don't have any choice in life, you very rarely have any dignity.
That really resonates for me too, because I know that my generation, a lot of my friends grew up with grandparents in the home or they're looking after their parents right now, particularly in COVID. Several of my friends have moved in with their parents in order to keep them out of long-term care, both in Canada and in the US. And I hadn't heard this expression, radical rest homes, but can't tell you how many times I've had that conversation over the last year where friends get in touch and say, you know what, if we find ourselves in this situation, let's start something before we get there. Let's find a way not to live in isolation or or not to be shunted aside, or not to have our children be in the position where they're making these agonizing decisions because they can't take care of us. You're living this, you're writing it, you're thinking about it and talking about it every day. It must have permeated your own sense of how do you plan ahead and think about managing this part of life with dignity and with some autonomy.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like everyone, I'm 60. I went through this with my parents, and like everyone I know my age, we all say the same thing. I don't want to go through what my parents went through, which is this loss of autonomy and, you know, respect of society, et cetera. We want to live differently, so we have to figure it out. And I think it starts with talking about it. Boomers have totally revolutionized Canadian society. They've sort of built the Medicare system. They've changed the education system. They've done these radical changes. And I don't quite understand why they've left this one untouched, especially that there's such a self-interest to do it. I think there really is going to be a big change. And as I said before, I think what's inspiring is I see even, you know, the millennials behind them being much more innovative. And just the notion of seeing their grandparents in these settings are like, oh, no, we're not going to stand for this. Right. So I think if that intergenerational cooperation, if we could tap into that, I think changes could happen really, really quickly. And things that we're not even imagining now could be in place relatively quickly if we allow people to do what they want, to build a society, to live how they want to live as they age.
Somebody wrote a review of the book, and they said they called you the master of quiet, matter-of-fact rage. Is that how you feel, or is that how you felt writing the book?
Yeah, it's a very nice description. I don't think I was always matter of fact about it, but I think there was a fair amount of raging. I really try and do what I said before, is just bring policy, this boring policy stuff, try and bring it to life, try and make it comprehensible and digestible to people. I just think it is so important, and it's so easy to ignore that you have to make it palatable for people because it's so important to their lives.
I hope that the book helps fuel the sweeping reset and respect that's needed now. I think the book is a stunning contribution. You certainly put everything there for us to work with. I really felt indebted when I was finished reading it.
Oh, that's very nice. You know, as you said at the beginning, it's not an easy read, but I tried to make it not too hard to read. It's deliberately a very short book. It's about stories about people that I hope everyone can associate with. And I think in the end, I really hope it is hopeful that it gives people, hey, yeah, this is all doable.
There's so much in the book. I hope everyone picks it up and reads it. I think it's actually one of those mandatory reads that we all have to do to be good people in the world. And perhaps we'll have part two.
Yeah, that would be great. I'm always happy to chat with you. You're always so insightful.
Oh, thank you, Andre. And thank you for the book. And let's wish ourselves good luck that we get it right this time. No more reports, inquiries, or commissions. Just action.
Exactly. Here's to happy aging.
Exactly. I'm with you.
Thanks for listening. I'm Ilana Landsberg-Lewis, your host of Grandmothers on the Move. If you want to find out more about me or the podcast, go to grandmothersonthemove.com and come back next week for another episode.